Public attacks have a personal cost. When someone is cancelled, it's their children, partner, and family who suffer. My guest today knows this all too well. Despite being avowedly left-wing and the creator of Black Books, Father Ted, and the IT Crowd.
Well, you know the way God made us all, right? And he's looking down at us from heaven and everything.
Uh-huh.
And then his son came down and saved everyone and all that.
Oh, yes.
And when we die, we're all going to go to heaven.
Yes. What about it?
Well, that's the bit I've trouble with.
I actually really want to know if you know many Australian shows, Australian comedy shows, any Australian comedians.
I don't really. The only thing I know, which I thought was one of the best pieces of television in the last few years, is Mr. In Between.
Okay, and I actually haven't watched that.
That's what kills me. A lot of Australians haven't. It is funny, but it's actually, it's kind of a black comedy, right, about a kind of a guy in the criminal underworld who's basically a fixer. And people just say, can you get this guy for me? And he goes, yeah, right. You know, and it's good. The actor, main actor in it, whose name, I never remember actors' names, but he's like the Australian Jack Nicholson.
Okay.
He'll be in a big, big movie as a Bond villain or something very, very soon.
I have heard great reviews.
Yeah.
So I'll have to watch it.
It's fantastic.
What do you think is the big difference between American and British humour? I think Australians tend to have a bit more British humour than American, but maybe sure, as time goes on, with more influence, we're more American, but...
It has something to do, I think, with how it's shot. Like, in the old days, British studio sitcoms like mine and The Young Ones and things like that, they used to be very surreal. They tended towards the surreal, for the most part. Well, maybe that's not entirely true. At least my favourite ones did, and the ones that seemed to have stood the test of time did. Whereas in America, the sitcoms were a lot more naturalistic and a lot more realistic. And they were about blue-collar workers a lot of the time, like Taxi and Cheers. And I always loved that. It was a kind of elegance to the way those were shot. And I remember the sets were extraordinary. In fact, the set on Cheers was so good that the producers actually gave him some of the royalties. Which I think is just shows the level of craftsmanship over there. So I was always kind of the former camp, doing surreal sitcoms. And when I was asked to go to America, I tried to do those classic Cheers-style sitcom. They asked me to do a version of the IT Crowd, so I used Taxi as a kind of a model, you know, like a big, wide-open space where not just the IT guys, but also the people, the janitors and the post people and all the people who keep a building like that going, a big office block going. And it didn't work. They didn't go for it, which was fine. But I think the other reason they didn't go for it is that around the time I was trying to write that, they switched into a more surreal mode themselves. So you had shows like 30 Rock and Brooklyn thingy. I can't remember what it's called. Brooklyn Nine-Nine?
Yeah. Yeah, I haven't watched it.
And these were more surreal and more silly and so on. So I was trying to be more American and they were getting more British and it just didn't work out.
So what led to this more surrealist American trend that's been happening? Is it The Office?
It's The Office, but it's also the switch from studio sitcoms, because their studio sitcoms were more, as I say, about the working classes and naturalistic and realistic, to single camera, where you could do tricks like... the way I would do these kind of tricks is that we would film it beforehand, put it on a monitor and show it to the audience in the order of the story. But in America, they didn't do that. Seinfeld did it a bit. It would cut and cut and cut many more locations in a Seinfeld episode, than there were in most sitcoms, because they were often a bit more surreal, you know? And they couldn't really do that in a naturalistic way. So it would be cut, cut, cut. And then when studio sitcoms went out of fashion, they all became single camera. And so you get you get so much more flexibility in what you can show. Like, I remember on 30 Rock, there's one joke where an actress says the camera adds 30 pounds and she steps in front of a camera and she's clearly been put into a fat suit, you know, but you don't see the time jump. So it's just an extremely funny joke. So they were able to, I think they were just able to do it. It gave the single camera thing gave them a lot more freedom, you know, and I think it's led to some great stuff. I think they do surrealism really well, you know. I just have a fondness for classic sitcoms, and I do prefer Seinfeld to Curb, for instance, you know.
I don't agree.
Really?
But I love both of them because Larry's involved.
Yes, me too. Me too. I just love the way he structures shows. Yeah. But for me, the reason I like Seinfeld was because being a very mainstream show, they had to jump through hoops to do certain things, like, for instance, the famous masturbation episode. Mm-hmm. Where they you know, came up with these brilliant phrases to avoid hitting it dead on. And I quite like that because it feels to me like a classic Cole Porter song or something where it's all subtext, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, with Curb, he's able to just use bad language and to be as coarse and whatever as he likes, which is fine. But I just love the art of Seinfeld, you know. Yeah.
You've had some issues getting into the country. Is that correct? Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, they first of all sat on the visa for a number of weeks. Usually takes 24 hours, I think. And as soon as it went past 24 hours, I knew why it was doing that. And I never look forward to anything that's coming up. So I was kind of like, oh, it's win-win. I either get like controversy about not being allowed into Australia, or I got to go to Australia. Either way, it's good. But I'm really glad they let me in because I've had a brilliant time.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. But yeah, they I can't say too much because trans activists, you know, they pay attention to stuff like this and they figure out things they can do to screw with you. So, but I will be saying a lot when I get back home, mm-hmm. you know, about that process.
Yeah.
It was very interesting.
Well, you just said something else very interesting, which is that you don't look forward to things. What's that about?
I'm just a naturally anxious person. Okay. I always, any kind of disruption, you know, it kind of messes with me a little bit. If I've got something I have to do on Wednesday, from the moment, you know, from Sunday, I'm like, oh God, I have that thing to do on Wednesday, mm-hmm. you know, and no matter how good it is, I always kind of, it always seems slightly fraught to me, but I recently went back on anti-anxiety medication because I kind of had to, because mm-hmm. when the book came out, it was sort of like being recancelled because people took the chance to say what they think of me everywhere they could. Mm-hmm. And my Wikipedia page, you know, that's where people get their information on me. That's kind of controlled by trans activists. So it's like being recancelled. So I just thought, things are tough. Australia's coming up, so I'll go back on the medication and see if that sorts things out. So it did.
I have a lot of sympathy regarding the Wikipedia page because Quillette's Wikipedia page is also
really
just
run
by activists, and I've tried to edit it but I can't.
Yeah, me too. It changes back within 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. So is that what you're trying to do in your latest book, in your memoir, Tough Crowd? Are you trying to give your own voice and to counter everything that you can find online?
Yeah. It's you know, the moment they asked me to write it, they said, we won't be able to pay you because it's a small publisher. But we will give you an extra share of the royalties when it comes out. And I didn't care. I just wanted to tell my story because on Twitter, it's kind of salami sliced. And someone can take one of those salami slices and use it to misrepresent you. I think someone said it's like shouting through straws. So I realized that far too late that it wasn't a good way to get myself across because I could be so easily misrepresented. So I realized I kind of had to write a book. You know, when journalists talked about me, they misrepresented me. Wikipedia was misrepresenting me. There's so far over 75 hit pieces written by propaganda magazine, Pink News. I just realized that the only way I could have a chance of getting my side of the story across was by writing a book. So I had a very kind of, it was a very frustrating writing period because I was writing it and I just didn't care about the comedy stuff, you know? And I was kind of writing a bit of the comedy stuff and then flashing forward to the GC stuff. And my editor said, you got to stop doing that. It's bouncing people out of the book. You have a good story to tell, tell it. So once I did that and I went back to the start and I started thinking, right, I really am going to have to look at things that I've been kind of taking for granted for years, my childhood and all that sort of stuff. And I'm really going to have to find the comedy in it and find what's interesting about it. And suddenly it became a really nice process. It was, you know, lots of things that I discarded or else have fluttered around the back of my mind for since I was a kid, suddenly came to the foreground and I realized there was kind of comedy in them and points of interest in them. And yeah, it was a really nice feeling. But when I did get to the GC stuff, to the feminism and the women's rights stuff, that's when I actually felt my mood lightening. I felt so confident actually that I started to come off the anti-anxiety medication, which I'd been on since the start of my cancellation. I wrote the end of the book just feeling lighter and lighter and lighter, and then I released it. And then the publicity came in and I had to go back on them again.
So what was it about your childhood and everything that led up to, you know, you being an adult that led to you being a gender critical feminist and activist in this space?
Just, I've always been left wing. I think I originally, oh God, this might get me re-cancelled. But I think when you're young and you read a lot and you're vaguely intellectual, feminism seems also, and I promise you this wasn't the only reason, but it was a way of meeting girls. Mm-hmm. You would meet interesting girls, you know.
Smart girls.
Girls. Unusual girls. Mm-hmm. Girls who didn't take any shit. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, I believed all these things. When I was, before I was 16, I was a real anti-abortion. I was very anti-abortion because I was Catholic. And even when I lost my faith, I thought there was something about, it was the abortion issue where I lost my faith. No, it wasn't. Sorry. No, even after I lost my faith, I kind of felt abortion, there was something deeply wrong with it. And it was still the last kind of hooks of Catholicism still in me. And I read a book called The Cider House Rules by John Irving, which was about abortion before it was legalized in America. And as soon as I read that, I just realized my position on it was untenable. I was kind of interested in not just the subject itself, but why I felt so strongly the other way and why that changed and so on. So I've always been kind of examining what I believe and why I believe it. And feminism has just been the consistent thing, you know, because I was hanging around with feminists. It just all soaked in. And also my dad was a big believer in chivalry and, you know, respecting women and being aware of the fact that they're physically, on average, not as strong as men. So, it's just an instinctive thing that my dad gave me. So when I saw people starting to bully women online because they believed in the reality of biology and single-sex spaces, protecting kids, you know, I just saw red, as I always do when I see bullying, you know. I was bullied at school as well, so that added to it.
Mm-hmm. So the, you know, this sort of started, many people believe, with the IT Crowd episode where there was a joke that people took very in the wrong way. That was in 2013.
Yeah, no, I believe. Was it 2013?
Oh, I don't know. You would know.
No, you may know better than me.
It was a long time ago.
People really, really liked the IT Crowd. So yeah. A lot of them let me away with it, right? Mm-hmm. But I did notice that the pushback was really vicious.
Yes.
And very male. I recognized it from other internet anti-feminist movements that I'd seen before that. Mm-hmm. But it surprised me because everyone was saying my trans friend this, my trans friend that. And I thought, hang on a sec. How did these people know so many transsexuals? Mm-hmm. And of course, then after a while, I realized they don't. They just know people who say I'm trans. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The percentage of men who claim a trans identity and have had surgery is something like 23% or something. It's a really small number. So I realized that trans was becoming this word that did not mean transsexuals.
When did you start to realize that? When was that?
Because when I wrote the IT Crowd episode, I still believed that trans meant transsexuals.
Well, it was a different era with different definitions almost, right?
Sure.
But we were on the cusp of it changing, I believe, around that time.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was kind of what had happened, I believe, is that it had kind of grown up in a kind of petri dish of Tumblr, where all these identities started to be kind of...
I was big on Tumblr. That's how I got into identity politics.
Right. Really. Yeah,
Marxism,
yeah.
Marxism, feminism, veganism, all of it.
Absolutely. Yeah. And all the kind of endless categories. Mm-hmm. And then they migrated from Tumblr when Tumblr banned porn, which mm-hmm. tells you a lot. They migrated from Tumblr to Twitter. Mm-hmm. And that was the moment, I think around 2015, 2014, when Twitter just became incredibly toxic mm-hmm. around this issue. And it became unsafe for women to talk about it. You know.
Had you always been using Twitter, or did you get a big following on Twitter after the gender critical?
No, gosh. I lost 400,000 followers when I started doing it. And I'm still, and my toxicity is still baked into the algorithm because, like, I'm still, when you search my name, all my impersonators come up first. Mm. And the same is true of Kelly J. Keene. You know, there's some of us who were marked as particular targets. And I think the coders at Twitter just built their dissatisfaction with my positions into the code. You know, there's no other explanation I can see that, unless Elon just doesn't like feminism, you know.
Hmm.
But So I genuinely kept thinking that, oh, well, I'll explain this to people, that trans no longer means transsexual, and they'll stop calling me transphobic. And nothing worked, you know. It was just, that was the new meaning of the word. And I still find it extraordinary that anyone could say that a transsexual who's been through surgery and hormones and all the rest of it for an extended amount of time and has had, taken extreme steps to feel comfortable in their body is the same as Eddie Izzard.
Yeah.
You know, puts on a pink beret and lipstick, which I bet he doesn't do when he's meeting Steven Spielberg, and goes into women's toilets. You know, I thought, how is that the same?
So I'm sure you would have written other skits that touched on, hot button topics. So what was it? What is it about this topic? I mean, I'm thinking of, do you know Catherine Tate and the Catherine Tate
yes.
show? You know, I love British comedy and that's what I grew up on. And I remember her jokes, you know, she has a skit where she impersonates different, cultures and does a fake Chinese language, fake African, fake, you know, and she got away with that.
Yes.
You know, granted it was probably around that period, 2013, but so why is the trans issue the sacred cow?
Because the people who benefit most from the trans issue are white men. And white men have always had the most power in Western society, and they continue to wield it through this new means. They realized that they were losing places on the social ladder because feminism was basically feminism was creating a more level playing field. And around the same time, I think there was also a kind of a little bit of overreach during Me Too, a little bit of men feeling kind of that they couldn't do anything without getting into trouble as the Me Too stories began to get less and less. You went from Harvey Weinstein to Aniz Ansari.
Exactly.
I think men basically just thought, I'm not having this, and they tried to get back on the ladder.
What about the women such as, I mean, in Australia, I'm thinking of Clementine Ford. She comes to mind first. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her. She's one of our most famous feminists, and she used to be seen as a radical feminist, but now she's definitely gone down that more liberal feminist route of gender over sex. Mm-hmm. She's definitely very pro trans rights, gender ideology. There are a number of feminists like this in the States, in the UK. How do you explain that women getting on board with this ideology that in so many ways is not good for us?
I don't know. I still find it one of the big mysteries about this whole subject. I think one thing that's very unfortunate is the lack of empathy for women who are on the other end of the social scale. Mm-hmm. A lot of these women who support trans rights tend to be middle class, very privileged, and so they don't have any thought for women in prison, women in rape crisis centers, women in shelters. They don't seem to, and women in sports, you know, like a lot of these women, I guess you would call them intellectuals. So they don't seem to have any interest in sports. They don't seem to realize how important it is for women and girls, especially, to have these ways they can excel without men just making their efforts, you know, irrelevant. I know, for instance, I met one woman who said that her daughter was a silver medalist in jiu-jitsu or something. I think it was jiu-jitsu. And she said she's just had to stop because she says, why should I train? Mm-hmm. You know, did these men come in and just beat us, you know? Mm-hmm. So, I think it's an extraordinary lack of empathy from some of the most privileged women in the world, you know?
Mm-hmm. So recently, you know, so many things have happened in this space. The Tavistock closed down. The NHS has just announced that they're going to stop prescribing puberty blockers to under 16s, which is great. Now, there's also the CAS review. These are all UK things. So maybe for our Aussie audience, can you explain a bit about what's been happening in the UK and about the CAS review?
Well, the CAS review has been years been assembled, and I'm not sure if it covers the entire medical side. All I know so far is that it's just been leaked, and apparently they've come to the conclusion that social transitioning, which is adopting male or opposite sex pronouns for a young child, has grave psychological consequences. They're the words they used. So that's massive. That's like, you know, every teacher, every school, you know, even things like the BBC's children's programs, Doctor Who, all of these products and institutions across, or products across the institutions and institutions across society have all been singing from the same hymn sheet, that social transitioning is what you do to alleviate the suffering of children with dysphoria. And of course, it, you know, we always knew, me and the TERFs, we always knew that it was nonsense. I remember on a Newsnight program when I was being interviewed about it by a very hostile interviewer, Sarah Smith, finally managed to get a word in. And I said, you don't tell children that they could be born in the wrong body because they're children and they will believe you. And this is what we've had. We've had the equivalent of adults telling children a very harmful version of the Santa story is true well into their adulthood. So I'm always in fear that I'll ruin Christmas, but I don't think there'll be many kids watching this. But if all of society, your parents, your teachers, the media, your school, your TV programs, if everyone together was saying that Santa was real and came down the chimney every Christmas dragging a sack of presents, you know, kids would believe it into, you know, for the same amount of time as the benefits of puberty blockers have been put forward. So it's been like a kind of mass psychosis, you know, a mass delusion. And these parents have been infecting their kids with it. And I just think that when these kids realize that they were told such a damaging lie, like, for instance, the Mayo Clinic has recently revealed that puberty blockers produce stones in testes of young kids that can turn into cancer. When these kids realize that their parents and the whole of society has been lying to them, I'm really worried about what that's going to do. You know,
mm-hmm. And yeah, we'll start to see it in the next few decades, I suppose. Yeah. And then how will these parents deal with that, with knowing that they've possibly sterilized their children, essentially. In many cases.
And there's all sorts of things that they don't get, you know, the BBC, The Guardian, The Independent, newspapers like that in the UK. I believe over here, the ABC is the same. They simply don't report on these things because they all have someone who's in the office who's either non-binary themselves or who has a non-binary child. And they know that if they even begin to open their mouths about these subjects, that they may lose their jobs, you know?
Yeah, and I know you had an issue in Melbourne, I believe, mm-hmm. With a comedy writing class where you had to change it.
I was told that I wouldn't be able to have any venue in this. I would not be allowed in any venue, any City of Melbourne Council venue.
Okay, City of Council, yeah. I can imagine because it's more... the government related, not that it's right, but we, Quillette, also had an issue in Melbourne. I was planning an event there. I'd been planning it for 6 months and 3 days before I got that dreaded phone call, which I knew was coming,
sure.
Which was that, you know, someone feels uncomfortable. They don't want to, you know, work. And I tried to explain to the manager, you are capitulating to one person who's now rewarded. Yeah. You know, people get rewarded from this power hungry behavior.
It has enabled a strata of society that I think has always been there and is there and comes up in different places at different times. You had the Khmer Rouge, mm-hmm. who were killing people who wore glasses. You had the Cultural Revolution. All of these movements empowered a class of kind of I don't know what you'd call them, but like a kind of policing class. Mm-hmm. And they're always there. And when you give them power, they'll misuse it, you know? So that's what this movement did. It gave a certain kind of sadistic, malicious, curtain-twitching gossip, mm-hmm. Sudden power over the rest of their, their friends and their social circles and so on, you know? And we've... all these reports that you mentioned, CAS report, the Mayo Clinic findings, all of these things prove that we were absolutely right all along. And all these people who encouraged their friends to break off contact with people in their social circle, to dehumanize them and cancel them and all that sort of stuff, they are the villains of history. Mm-hmm. And I do think we should offer what's called a golden bridge to a lot of people, because I think that some of the parents who did this to their kids, they did so under a lot of pressure. They had the whole of society telling them it was the right thing to do. And meanwhile, their kids were repeating the line that they would commit suicide if they weren't allowed to do it. They've got to be offered, you know, every consideration, every sympathy. But the people who took pleasure in policing it, they need to be named and shamed and never listened to again, you know?
Do you have the same sympathy for the people who believed these people who...
Sure, you know? Yeah. I mean, my thing is, I tweeted it recently, but the way I put it is we should shun the influencers, arrest the doctors, and protect the survivors, you know, or help the survivors. That's the way I feel about it.
So for people, you know, colleagues of yours, many of them quite famous writers, comedians who have publicly either shamed you, like Graham Norton to mm-hmm. some extent, other writers, how, if they came to you tomorrow to say, I'm sorry, you know, I've just read the CAS review, it looks like you were actually right about some things, how would you feel?
Well, I don't think it's going to happen. So okay. it doesn't really, I think they will just pretend they didn't say anything. They all played a very clever game. Like Graham Norton, for instance, he never named me. He just said that that cancel culture was actually consequence culture. Mm. And it was the consequence of the beliefs of people like me that were leading to my losing my livelihood and my marriage, you know? And, you know, so I don't think, I think if I was him, I would be too embarrassed to ever speak to me again. But, you know, the only way, the one guy, Louis Theroux, once wrote to me, and I said, 5 years too late, Louis, say it in public or don't say it at all. You have to say it in public. You know, we were publicly shamed, publicly demolished. So these people should publicly make statements going the other way. And if that happens, yeah, I'd be delighted. I do think that in general, you know, there does need to be some sort of truth and reconciliation process. Because as I say, there's a lot of innocent people caught up in it who believed what they were told by people they were told were experts. What we were saying earlier about the Wikipedia issue, you know, they Google my name and the first thing that they see is a page of Google results saying that I'm a bigot. So, you know, what are they supposed to think? At the same time, the people who are close to me, and I've been betrayed by people who could not be closer to me. But those people, they should have got in touch. They should have asked me what my views were. They should have, you know, talked to me. But none of them did. They went straight to the press. They went straight to, you know, they just went straight to denunciations and public denunciations. So, yeah, they've got a lot of making up to do, but I don't think they'll do it. I don't think I'll ever work in the UK again. I don't think I could work with those people.
Wow. You know? So I can imagine this has had a massive toll on your mental health. You talked briefly about being on anti-anxiety medication. How has it been in Australia? Have you felt the same anxiety here? Is it different being, you know, far away across the pond from these people?
No, it's been lovely ever since I got here. The brilliant thing, I've got the Free Speech Union here. And, you know, like in the old days, I would, you know, be asked to do something like an Oxford debate. And then the next day I'd get a call saying it's been cancelled. And those really hit me hard, every single one of them. But now, because the Free Speech Union is so used to these tactics, they always line up a second venue, you know, everything's ready to go. So it only seems like a pause before everything just continues as it was. So I've had a really relaxing, you know, they just tell me in the morning where I'm going and I go. And everywhere I've gone, I've just met people who are either thankful or grateful or whatever word you want to use, like about my stance on the feminism issue, or they just love Father Ted and black books and the IT crowd.
And who are some of your favorite comedians or writers right now?
Right now, Dave Chappelle. His last special, I was a bit disappointed. It felt a little bit undercooked. But the ones before that, the run of specials before that, I just think are some of the best comedy I've ever seen. Shane Gillis, who was cancelled. He was supposed to do Saturday Night Live, and they did what I call Oppo research. They went through his history, and they found something they could use against him. Publicized it, and he lost the job, but he kind of bounced back. People love him more than ever. He's and the extra scrutiny on him reveals nothing except a really charming, sweet guy who, you know, wouldn't hurt a fly, you know. So there's a few people. I like people who can step between all the tripwires that woke kind of sheep have set up, you know, and Chappelle is particularly skilled at that. He, you know, he kind of comes close to the wire with some of the Jewish stuff, which I haven't been enjoying recently. Mm. But still, he's just a master.
What about Ricky Gervais?
Well, my problem with anti-woke comedy is, for me, it's pinned to the present too much.
Okay.
I find anti-woke comedy kind of as too easy, you know. It's like very low hanging fruit. So I like making fun of woke people, but I don't know, for a more substantial thing like a comedy set or a TV show, I wouldn't like to do it that dead on. It's just not my interest.
Okay.
I like to come at things obliquely.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
do you think that this, well, woke culture in general, and maybe more specifically gender ideology will blow over? And if it does, will you go back to writing more comedy?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'm writing something at the moment that's looking good, that's looking possible. I think that the medical scandal will topple everything else, because all the people who, endorse woke kind of viewpoints or woke points of view, they all have pronouns in their bio. They all supported trans kids, and they're all guilty. They're all culpable of what Michael Schellenberger and Jordan Peterson recently said is the greatest medical scandal of all time. And I don't think it can be argued. It's been a huge live experiment on children. And when people finally realize, when all the Wikipedia pages and when the BBC fires its LGBTQ staff, when all that happens and we finally see what's been going on, I think the whole world will combine in trying to ensure that it never happens again. And the first thing we can do to ensure that it never happens again is never listen to these people again.
Great. And to keep talking about it, and for people to have, backbones, and to publicly, as you were saying before, like, don't say it privately, say it publicly. Support me publicly.
Yeah. The people who are scared should realize that they've got a lot more cover now. Like they can just say the cast report. They can say story of Kira Bell. Mm-hmm. They can say the Mayo Clinic report. Mm-hmm. The reversal of the puberty blockers decision in the UK. All of these things give them a lot of cover, and so they can challenge without fear of having their lives destroyed. I think cancel culture, at least when it comes to the gender issue, might be on its way out.
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
So if people want to catch you in Australia, where are you going next? If you remember, there are probably so many shows. You've already been to New Zealand. Yeah. Now you're in Australia.
Yeah, I've been to Hobart and Melbourne and Adelaide. And I think next we're off to
Newcastle this weekend, my hometown.
That's right. And then Perth, I think, and Brisbane, hopefully. Where else? A few other places.
Okay. Check the Free Speech Union website for more details. But you're doing comedy writing workshops.
Mm-hmm.
And can people also buy your book there?
Yes, there will be copies of the book. They didn't get them in time in New Zealand, but luckily they've arrived for Australia. Yeah. So yeah, signed copies. And if you do have trouble getting the book, because bookshops are still hiding it,
mm-hmm.
Or bookshop staff are still hiding it, just buy it online.
Great. And it's got great reviews online, I've already seen.
Okay, good. Yeah. Excellent.
Okay, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you. That was great.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. If you want to know more information, you can head to the Free Speech Union of Australia's website. I'll link it below.